Well, first I'd like to thank the organizers, to thank Owen, Rob, and Hans for inviting me to give this talk. It's been a while since I've been here at the Perimeter Institute, and I'm glad to be back. I always enjoy visiting here. Am I talking loud enough? So I'm going to talk about the role of the wave function in quantum mechanics, and mainly in Bohmian mechanics, but maybe a little more broadly. The work I'll talk about will be joint work with Detlef Thuer and Nino Zangi. I think it's kind of fairly nice that nowadays, this is the first conference I really know about where the focus of the conference is on the state vector, new perspectives on the state vector, other than quantum state. I mean, it's just kind of appropriate because that's kind of the big innovation in quantum mechanics. And in some sense, there's been, over the years, not as much focus on that issue as you might have expected there to be. Let me begin with a quotation from Einstein. I did not grow up in the Kantian tradition, but came to understand the truly valuable, which is to be found in this doctrine, alongside of errors, which today are quite obvious, only quite late. It is contained in the sentence, "The real is not given to us, but put to us by way of a riddle." This obviously means there is such a thing as a conceptual construction for the grasping of the interpersonal, the authority of which lies purely in its validation. This conceptual construction refers precisely to the real, by definition. And every further question concerning the nature of the real appears empty. I used this quotation to begin a lecture a while ago, and at the time I said I basically more or less agreed with everything in it. Now I'm not so sure that I totally agree with it, as you might see. Anyway, our main question, the main question of this conference is presumably, what the hell is this strange thing, the wave function that we have in quantum? So what's going on with that? Who ordered that? So is it, for example, is it subjective, epistemic, or is it objective? Does it merely provide information, or is it describe an observer-independent reality? What's the deal with collapse? Why does it collapse? What's going on there? If it's objective, is it some sort of concrete material reality or something else? Let me say a word about what it means to me to say the wave function is merely epistemic. To me, that means there's something else, which I'm calling X here. Could be the value of a variable, the result of an experiment, or maybe the whole history up to the present or forever of some variable, a collection of variables, things we're primarily interested in. And then what the wave function is just simply equivalent to say the wave function is merely epistemic, the wave function is equivalent to some probability distribution on the set of possible values of X. Then it's merely epistemic. You should note that orthodox quantum theory is not of this form, because the X would be a hidden variable, and there are no hidden variables in orthodox quantum theory, it's just the wave function, so it's certainly not of that form. And neither is Bohmian mechanics quite of that form. After all, in Bohmian mechanics, it's indeed the case that the wave function sort of has a probabilistic role to play. Psi squared gives the probability of the configuration X. But that's not the fundamental role of the wave function in Bohmian mechanics, which is something quite different, certainly not the most important role. There are, I think we would all agree, and maybe this is the only thing we should all agree upon, I hope we would agree on this, that there are three possibilities for the wave function. Either it's everything, as would seem to be the case with Everett, or it would seem to be the most modest view, it's something but not everything, as with Bohmian mechanics, for example. The wave function, or there's something else. Or maybe it's nothing, as one would, you know, that would solve the problem of what's this weird thing, the wave function. We don't really have it. You can get rid of it. Let me turn to Bohmian mechanics. For me, the sort of the simplest version of quantum mechanics. As I said, in Bohmian mechanics, you've got the usual quantum mechanical wave function, but it's not everything. In addition to the wave function, you've got the positions of the particles for an n-particle system, q1 through qn, which form a configuration q. I call the positions of the particle the primitive ontology of the theory, to indicate, to say that the whole point of the wave function, the whole point of the theory is to prescribe, to define a motion for the particles. And it's in terms of this motion that pointers end up pointing and the experiments end up having results, the kind of results which is the whole point of quantum mechanics to explain. So the connection to physical reality in the theory would be via what I'm calling the primitive ontology, in Bohmian mechanics, the positions of the particles. The wave function would seem to be part of the ontology. It's real in that sense. It's not subjective in Bohmian mechanics. It has a rather real role to play. It has to govern the motion of the particles, but it's not part of the primitive ontology. Bohmian mechanics is fundamentally about particles and their motions, not about wave functions. Here are the equations of Bohmian mechanics. You've got, first of all, just for the wave function, the usual Schrodinger equation. Nothing new there, the usual Schrodinger Hamiltonian. So the only thing Bohmian mechanics adds, in addition to the positions of the particles as actual variables in the theory to be taken seriously, and not just talked about in connection with measurement, is an equation of motion for the positions. And the equation of motion for the positions, written in blue there, the new equation in Bohmian mechanics, is kind of an obvious equation. It's kind of the first thing you would guess if you were trying to guess. What is the simplest motion that the particles that could be defined in terms of the wave function? It may not look so obvious, that equation there. You might notice it looks a bit pointless to have psi star in both numerator and denominator where it cancels. When it does cancel, you're just left with grad psi over psi with a prefactor, which is the same as grad s over m, the familiar way of writing the right-hand side, the more familiar way of writing the right-hand side of the velocity field, that is, in Bohmian mechanics. There's a good reason for writing it this way, two good reasons. As written, this makes sense automatically for spin, for particles with spin. Then psi is a spinner value wave function. Grad psi over psi wouldn't make any sense because what the hell would be meant by the ratio of two spinner value things? And even if you could make sense of that, why should that be a scalar? Which the velocity should be. Each component of the velocity should be a scalar. Well, if you interpret this product, psi and grad psi, psi star and grad psi, and psi star and psi in the denominator for spinners in the usual way as a spinner inner product, and that's the natural way of interpreting such an expression. It's the natural kind of expression to form for spinners. So with the very same formula that is valid for particles without spin, you have an equation of motion for particles with spin, which does exactly what you want it to do. It works perfectly. So you don't need to do anything extra in Bohmian mechanics to deal with spin. That's one reason for writing the equation that way. The other reason is because, well, the denominator is obviously rho, psi star psi. The numerator is the quantum probability current J. So the right-hand side is J over rho, which is, first of all, a fairly obvious thing to guess for a velocity, J over rho. And second of all, it's because the velocity is J over rho that psi squared probabilities play the role they do, the special role they do in Bohmian mechanics. Few words about derivation or motivation or where the velocity equation comes from in the theory. There are a whole slew of arguments of why the right-hand side on the bottom in blue is the right thing to write down. There's 10 that I know of. 10 rather different arguments all leading to the same formula. We just do what comes naturally. The simplest, and which requires no quantum mechanics, very little real quantum mechanics, doesn't even require you to focus much on Schrodinger's equations, because it's a pre-Schrodinger equation argument. You take the de Broglie relation, which was a distillation of all of the quantum known quantum facts up to the formation of quantum mechanics itself. It is, in terms of thinking about Schrodinger's the de Broglie relation, that one arrives at Schrodinger's equation is the simplest wave equation somehow reflecting P equals h bar k. Even more directly, P equals h bar k suggests the velocity formula, grad s over m, because after all, this is for a particle momentum m, that is a mass, the left-hand side is then mass times velocity. So we have a formula for velocity in terms of a wave property k, making perfect sense for plane waves, which what k is well-defined. And for a non-plane wave, you might, for a general wave function, you should ask, well, what the hell should that mean? It should be a local wave vector. You think about what that means. It's grad s. So this is sort of just as easily as you get Schrodinger's equation of p equals h bar k, you get the Bohm velocity equation. It's suggested just as strongly. And I guess everybody has seen the two slit the trajectories for the two slit experiment. The only thing to notice about it is that it is just the way you would expect it to be the case, namely when the wave function from the upper slit overlaps the wave function from the lower slit. You seem to see an interference pattern in the trajectories. This is a sampling of a bunch of trajectories uniformly distributed in this list. The trajectories start to show an interference pattern just when they should, because their motion is governed by a wave function, which itself is developing an interference pattern when the waves overlap. Bohmian mechanics has lots of implications, and one problem with Bohmian mechanics is its implications are, it too much agrees with quantum mechanics. It agrees exactly with quantum mechanics. Therefore, people say, what good is it? It just gives me quantum mechanics back. There are no new predictions. It would be nice if there were new predictions, but the only possibility for new predictions, as Anthony emphasizes, is if you have quantum non-equilibrium, which of course is a possibility, but the simplest possibility is quantum equilibrium. In some sort of formal sense, or intuitive sense, the most likely possibility is quantum equilibrium. And in that case, there's absolute agreement between Bohmian mechanics and orthodox quantum theory. Absolute agreement. One of the most interesting implications is that all the aspects of quantum mechanics emerge, but in particular, quantum randomness comes out in a very compelling way. And in a way which involves real absolute uncertainty, you can't get beyond. The uncertainty principle really does become absolute in Bohmian mechanics, in quantum equilibrium. Operators as observables emerge in Bohmian mechanics, even though they're not put in as observables in the formulation of the theory. They emerge as the objects which play a natural role in the description of results in the statistics for measurements, for experiments. A crucial element in analysis of all of the implications of Bohmian mechanics is the notion of the wave function of a subsystem. Subsystem of a bigger system. Bigger system being the universe. So I want to talk a little bit more about the wave function of a subsystem than I will about other stuff. Now, there's some transparencies up here, some slides about probability. I don't want to go into have time to talk about probability in Bohmian mechanics here. The way you should think about the probability in Bohmian mechanics is pretty much as analogous to probability and roughly analogous to probability in statistical mechanics. Maxwellian velocities characterize the statistics for the molecules of a gas in a box. Similarly, psi squared probabilities characterize statistics for configurations in Bohmian mechanics. And the discussion in the two cases is really quite parallel in statistical mechanics and in Bohmian mechanics, but I won't go into it at all here, hardly at all. One remark, Ward Stroiva and I proved a while ago that the quantum equilibrium distribution is, in fact, in a sense, unique. Quantum psi-squared probabilities are unique in the sense of first of all, you would like any kind of probability distribution associated with the wave function to keep up with the wave function, so that psi-squared probabilities should be preserved, the probabilities should be preserved by the Bohm motion as the wave function evolves according to Schrodinger's equation. You demand that of a probability distribution, and demand also that in a suitable sense, the probability distribution depends in a local way on the wave function. You have to be dealing with psi-squared probabilities. Now I want to focus on the question of how should we think about the wave function of a subsystem? That's what we're always thinking about. We're almost never dealing, who the hell knows what the wave function of the universe is? Who thinks about the universe? Only cosmologists. deal with subsystems all the time, a hydrogen atom, a particle in a Stern-Gerlach experiment, what the hell, some small system. And yet, from a fundamental point of view, in Bohmian mechanics, the only real Bohmian system, the only system you can be sure is Bohmian in a Bohmian universe, is the universe itself. It can't be an immediate consequence of that, that subsystems of the Bohmian universe are themselves Bohmian, governed by wave functions. The behavior of a part of a big system are going to be determined by the behavior of the whole. So you're not free to impose X rules on the parts. What's true of the parts has to be a consequence of the behavior of the whole. So, and what you have for the whole is a wave function for the whole universe, together with the configuration of the universe. That's your data. That's what's objective. If you're going to get your hands on a wave function of a subsystem, it's going to have to be something definable in terms of that data, the wave function of the universe, a function. If we are thinking of a subsystem of the universe, corresponding to that subsystem are its configuration, Q system X, and then there's the rest of the environment of the subsystem, the configuration of everything else in the universe, Q environment, Y. So you have X, Y. X is a system, Y is configuration of the environment. You have capital X, capital Y, the actual configuration of the system, the actual configuration of the environment. You have the wave function psi of little x, little y. That's all you've got. It should be from that data that you construct the wave function of the subsystem. And so the first guess people make about what that should be is usually turns out to be wrong, but the right guess, and I think sort of the natural thing to do, is to define the wave function of a subsystem as I've you take the wave function of the universe, capital psi, and for the configuration, what do you want? The wave function of a subsystem should be a function of its configuration. You have a function of the configuration of the system and environment. You want to have just a function of the configuration of the system still. Stick in the actual objective configuration of the environment in the environment slot. You end up with a function of the system, the configuration of the system itself. If you think about it, that's exactly the right definition of the wave function of a subsystem. It evolves. It has an interesting time dependence. Time appears in the wave function of a subsystem in actually two places. You have the wave function of the universe evolving according to Schrodinger's equation and therefore involving time in that respect. But you also have the configuration of the environment, which evolves as one half of the, as part of the configuration of the whole universe, which is evolving according to the Bohm equation of motion, the configuration of the environment involves. So you have this double time dependence in the wave function of a subsystem of the universe, which means that there are a possibility of a rich variety of ways that thing might behave in time. Now, it should come as no surprise. Everybody should readily believe, and in fact it is the case, that this wave function of a subsystem in Bohmian mechanics evolves just as it should according to Schrodinger's equation for the subsystem when the subsystem is suitably decoupled from its environment. And it's actually rather easy to see that the wave function of a subsystem collapses according to the usual textbook rules with the usual textbook probabilities in the usual measurement situation. It collapses in just the way wave functions are supposed to collapse during the measurement. This second thing is really easy to see, just more or less follows immediately from standard measurement theory together with the definition of the wave function of a system. And it basically assumes, of course, quantum equilibrium. You can't get any probability statements out without having probability. The probability statements in Bohmian mechanics are contingent on quantum equilibrium. The sociological fact, for whatever reason, even very talented mathematical physicists have a lot of trouble accepting that wave function of a subsystem should collapse as it's supposed to. I guess because people know that collapse is supposed to be some really hard thing, so it can't be something easy for Bohmian mechanics. But it is easy for Bohmian mechanics. And the thing everybody is happy to take for granted, of course, you'll have Schrodinger's equation for the wave function of a subsystem because we're just used to. Nobody says there's a fundamental problem having Schrodinger's equation. It's a fundamental problem getting collapsed. But actually, this is a little trickier, understanding why the wave function of a subsystem under suitable situations when the system is suitably decoupled from its environment actually obeys the balls according to Schrodinger's equation. But I'm not going to go into any details about why that's true. You readily believe that. Well, here's a transparent slide about giving you the details about how collapse comes about, but I don't think I'll spend any time on that. If you know standard measurement theory and what happens in a standard measurement situation where you get a superposition of quantum states involving states of system tensed with state of apparatus summed over all the possibilities, which is the measurement problem, what you find, that of course, you have that same wave function in Bohmian mechanics, but you don't have the measurement problem for two reasons. You don't have the measurement problem because you actually have pointers pointing, because pointers are made of particles, and particles have positions, and positions of pointers define orientations. And not only that, the wave function of the system, not of the system and apparatus together, but of the whole of the system itself, a small subsystem, not the system and apparatus, will indeed collapse when you just plug the definition into the superposition, which is the wave function of system and apparatus after the experiment. That'll pick out one term and will give you, and it will pick out that term with just the right probability so that the transition that occurs in an Bohmian experiment is exactly the textbook transition from the initial wave function to an eigenstate of the observable measured with the right probability. Let me go on. Now, the main thing I want to talk about is the status of the wave function, what kind of thing it is. And what I want to suggest that one think about is the possibility that it's nomological, nomic, law-like. It's really more law than anything else, the wave. This is thoughts in this direction might originate when you consider the weird kind of strange, the unusual kind of way that Bohmian mechanics is formulated, that the unusual kind of behavior that the wave function undergoes in Bohmian mechanics. The wave function, of course, affects the configuration, the behavior of the configuration. That's precisely what the equation in blue on the bottom says. The way the configuration's behavior is governed by the wave function. But there's no back action. There's no arrow in the other direction. The wave function in a Bohmian system, the wave function evolves autonomously according to Schrodinger's equation. The configuration is not in that equation. If the Bohmian configuration has to be in that equation, then orthodox quantum theory would have required the Bohmian position, which of course it does not. So that's one point. Second point is the wave function, as we all know, ain't just some weird field on physical space. It's a weird field on configuration space. The set of all hypothetical configurations of a system, that ain't physical space. So what kind of a thing is that? Now that bothers a lot of people, and it bothers a lot of people here, I'm sure, as well. It doesn't bother me, by the way, all that much, but it does. It does seem like a significant piece of information, nonetheless. And what it suggests to me is that you should think of the wave function as sort of describing the law, not some sort of concrete physical reality. After all, there's an equation of motion, dq dt equals something. The right-hand side is a law. The whole point of the wave function is to give you the law, the right-hand side. Now, I said that rather cavalierly. There are lots of problems with saying that at this point. But before going into the problems, let me make a comparison with a familiar situation where nobody seems to have much problem at all. That is in classical Hamiltonian dynamics. Wave function is strange because it's on configuration space. For an n particle system of a space of dimension 3n, well, there's a space in classical mechanics which has twice that dimension, the phase space, dimension 6n. On that space, there's a function, the Hamiltonian. It's what you put on the right-hand side after taking derivatives to define the equations of motion in Hamiltonian mechanics. I've never heard anybody say whoa, what a weird thing classical mechanics is. You've got this weird field on phase space there. What kind of thing is that? Nobody has any problem with that, because everybody knows the Hamiltonian is just a convenient device to express the equations of motion. I'm suggesting that you should think of the wave function as in exactly that sort of way. And if you want to have a sharper analogy, you should think of not psi itself, but something like log psi as corresponding to the Hamiltonian H. The reason I suggest that is because the velocity in Bohmian mechanics, the rate of change of the configuration, in these first order equations, you can't see it there, it was basically grad psi of psi for a scalar wave function. Gradient, basically, something like the gradient of the log psi, the imaginary part of that, some kind of derivative of the log psi. Well, what kind of thing do we have in classical mechanics? You take some sort of derivation, some sort of derivative of the Hamiltonian, some sort of skewed partial derivative of the Hamiltonian gives you the right-hand side of the equation of motion in classical mechanics. dQ dt is dH dp, dP dt is minus dH dq. Similar kind of thing. True also that both log psi and h are defined only up to an additive constant. You add a constant to the Hamiltonian, doesn't change the equations of motion. Where we all say that if you multiply the wave function by a scalar, it describes the same physical state. It doesn't matter. When you take normalized wave functions or normalized choices, you have rather similar probability formulas in the two cases. In classical mechanics and statistical mechanics, the canonical probability formula is e to the minus beta h. The log of the probability is proportional to h, or minus h. Here, the log of the absolute value of psi, probability is psi squared, so the log of absolute, so the log of the probability is log, again, of this thing, absolute psi. I put that in gray because you really shouldn't take that at all seriously. To me, it's just sort of an accident. The analogy is as good as it is. Don't take it seriously. Maybe you can hardly see it. But there are problems in thinking of the wave function as nomological. Laws aren't supposed to be dynamical. They're not supposed to change with time. But the wave function of a system changes with time. Laws are not supposed to be something we control. We're not God. But the wave function functions as, is thought of often as usually as an initial condition for a system. We prepare a system with a certain wave function. We control wave functions. We don't control laws. So that sort of makes it a little more difficult to think of the wave function as nomological. But in this regard, it's important to remember that there's actually only one wave function we should be worrying about, the fundamental one, the wave function of the universe. The wave function of a subsystem is definable directly in terms of that other wave function, so we only have to worry about that other wave function, the wave function of the universe. And once we come to the wave function of the universe, the situation is rather dramatically transformed. On the universal level, the wave function of the universe ain't controllable. It is what it is. And it ain't exactly dynamical either. First of all, the significance of dynamical is transformed by general relativity. A 3-1 structure, space separated from time, is transformed to a 3+1 four-dimensional structure where you can't separate so easily or even really in any serious sense space and time. And in fact, there may well be no T in the wave function of the universe, psi, capital psi. The DeWitt equation, some sort of generalized Laplacian on a space of including at least three metrics and maybe other stuff. The Wheeler-DeWitt equation involves only objects, structures on three spaces, no time in it at all. In the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. That's, in fact, the problem of time in quantum gravity, quantum cosmology. We live in a world where things change, but if the basic object in the world is a timeless wave function, how does change come about? So there's a whole slew of answers to that. But what I want to emphasize here is that from a Bohmian perspective, this is not a problem. This is what the doctor ordered. The fundamental role of the Bay function in Bohmian mechanics was to govern the motion of something else. Change fundamentally occurs in Bohmian mechanics not because the wave function changes, but because the thing it's governing evolves according to the law determined by the wave function. Just what the doctor ordered, because we have to, the laws are not supposed to change with time, so we don't want the wave function, the fundamental wave function, to change with time. It's good that it doesn't change with time. The problem of time vanishes entirely from a Bohmian point of view. And the whole point of the wave function from a Bohmian point of view is to give some sort of law of motion which is naturally expressible, as it turns out, in terms of a wave function. The more timeless, the better, as you have in quantum cosmology. The more unique, the better. So if you need to put additional conditions on the Wheeler DeWitt equation, for example, a Hartle-Hawking boundary condition or whatever, to make that wave function universe, make it unique, so much the better. We're stuck with one wave function in the universe anyway. The more unique, the better. Otherwise, you have to question, why that one? Yeah, you still might say, okay, fine, stuff changes, the particles move, gravitational fields change, the metric evolves, whatever, according to this equation of motion. But what the hell? We know there is a Schrodinger revolution in the theory. There is Schrodinger's equation of persistence. Where the hell does that come from in a theory where you had only a timeless wave function, capital Psi? But that's connected with what I mentioned earlier, that if you have a wave function of the universe evolving according to Schrodinger's equation, then under suitable situations, when a system is suitably decoupled from its environment, the wave function of a subsystem will evolve according to a Schrodinger's equation for that subsystem. Here, we have a wave function, capital Psi, which doesn't involve time, but it's nonetheless a solution to the time-dependent Schrodinger's equation. It's just the time-dependent Schrodinger equation in which the Psi dt term is zero because there's no t in Psi. Solves the equation nonetheless. And so the wave functions of subsystems should evolve according to Schrodinger's equation and under suitable circumstances. But here we have a situation where the Schrodinger revolution is not fundamental. It's phenomenological. It's emergent. It's a situation in which even the time-independent wave function of the universe, which seems to solve its wave function universe seems like it's given fundamentally by an equation which is a Schrodinger-type equation. It's a time-independent Schrodinger equation. But even that might be an illusion in the following sense. You've got a law of motion involving some vector field, deep psi. It's something you can write in terms of a wave function psi. If this is a nice kind of wave function, it'll satisfy all kinds of equations. Among those equations, it might be satisfy an equation of that form. From a fundamental point of view, it could be totally an accident that an equation of the Wheeler-Witt form, it satisfies an equation of that form. It just happens to satisfy that equation. That satisfaction of that equation may, in fact, have nothing to do with why that was the right kind of dynamics. But as long as it does satisfy that equation, by accident or not, all the consequences of satisfying that equation follow. So it could turn out at the end of the day that what we take to be the fundamental equation of quantum mechanics, Schrodinger's equation, actually has nothing fundamentally to do with quantum mechanics. It's not a fundamental equation of the theory on any level, but an emergent and accidental equation. Now I want to just focus a bit on the change of perspective that takes place when we make a transition from orthodox quantum theory, which just seems to just involve wave function, to Bohmian mechanics, which seems to involve two things, the wave function, two kinds of reality, the wave function and the positions of the particles, forming a configuration. To universal Bohmian mechanics, where somehow the wave function is somehow out of the reality into the law, so you're back with just Q. You start with just Psi, you end with just Q. And in the original question about the nature of the wave function, what kind of thing is that? It becomes rather dramatically transformed when we make this transition to the universal level, because now we're asking not about a very different object, not about a wave function in general or wave function of a subsystem, we're answering a question about the wave function of the universe, but it's actually just a way of defining the law of motion. And so what kind of question remains about that? Well, why should the motion be of that form? Why should the motion of whatever, of the constituents of the universe be of such a form that there's a wave function which determines that motion? I think that's a good question. And of course, I have no definitive answer, but an answer to that question would be a real understanding of why our world is quantum mechanical. The view that the wave function is nomological has another helpful feature in it. Let me explain this. What's the last question here? The question involves, how the hell do we ever know what the wave function of a system is? There must be some algorithm we use. We don't directly see wave functions. The stuff we see, let's say, maybe we see particles. And from a Bohmian perspective, you would say what we see are the particles. So we should read off from the primitive ontology, whatever it may be. There should be some algorithm to read off from that what the wave function of a system is. Now let's go to the universal level. You would think there should be some algorithm to read off from the primitive ontology of the universe, whatever that may be, the state of that primitive ontology, what the wave function of the universe is. I kind of doubt there's any such algorithm. Nobody's proposed any such algorithm. And from the point of view of the wave function being nomological, you wouldn't expect there to be any such algorithm. Because if the wave function is nomological, then specifying the wave function is specifying the theory, and you wouldn't expect there to be an algorithm for theory formation. Now, I can imagine, quite sure, many physicists would react to this question about it, whether or not the wave function is nomological, nomic, law-like, with a big, who cares, what business does it make? And I think it does sort of matter. If something is law-like, there are consequences of that. Law-like, laws should be simple. So if the wave function of the universe should be thought of, if the wave function of the universe should be thought of as nomological, well, that should govern our that should determine our, limit our expectations for the development of physics. We should expect to somehow find, arrive at physics in which somehow the wave function of the universe involved is in some sense simple. Probably having also satisfying a variety of other features as well. Now, simplicity itself is kind of complicated. There are a number of varieties of simplicity. For example, the wave function could be simple in the sense that it's just a simple function, has a simple functional form and argument. One possible kind of simplicity. Or, quite different, it could be a more or less unique solution to some simple equation. Or a similar kind of thing. It could be more or less uniquely satisfy some compelling principle, some symmetry principle. Now, this next transparency slide concerns one attempt I made with Stefan Teufel to actually try to see what a sort of symmetry principle based on quasi-four diffeomorphism invariance would imply. I don't want to go into any details here because it doesn't really, all what you get, you demand somehow that the vector field defining the relevant motion be a form of representation of the Dirac algebra. What is there? That Dirac algebra sort of corresponds to four diffeomorphism invariance. When you do that, that puts very strong constraints on the kind of theory you're talking about. The constraints are so strong that it seems that you only get back general relativity, nothing really quantum mechanical. It's not really clear what would happen. That was for pure gravity. It's not clear what would happen if you include matter fields. And so one could always hope that if you include matter in the story and play a similar game, you're going to end up with quantum mechanics that way. But I think it's highly speculative, and it's only a hope and a prayer. I want to say a few words about Lorentz invariance and a problem that arises in connection with Lorentz invariance. It's usually said that it's natural to think you can't have a Lorentz invariant Bohmian theory. Because in a Bohmian theory, the configuration, positions of the particle at a given time play an important role. You can also talk about configurations determined by not a T equals constant surface, but a general space like hypersurface. You look at where are the world lines corresponding to n particles all across a given surface. That defines a configuration. So if in fact you had somehow Lorentz invariant foliation, a suitable foliation of space-time, you could play a Bohmian game and define a Bohmian theory, which was Lorentz invariant. To actually have such a thing, the best thing would be a situation where you had a rule for defining, in terms of the wave function of the universe, the foliation of space-time, a covariant map, fold, from wave functions to foliations. If you had such a covariant map, and that if covariant means the diagram on the bottom is commutative. And here's some examples of possibilities for foliations. You could form a typical kind of quantum expectation in the Heisenberg picture involving the wave function of the universe and some sort of fields, operator-valued Fermi fields and quantum fields. They form a usual kind of tensor operators, take the expectation, get a tensor field, a vector field, or Ward suggested using this stress-energy tensor to get and integrate that over surfaces. To get a vector. There are a variety of proposals which would give you a vector field on space-time. A vector field on space-time is just the kind of thing which can define a foliation as the surface orthogonal to that vector field. Now, you'd have to do a lot of massaging to get that to work, because the vector field would have to be an involution, so you'd have to do some work. But the bottom line is there's lots of structure in the wave function, enough structure certainly to define lots of rules for foliations. But there is a problem. And that problem is that there's a sort of tension between wave function being nomological, Ward-like, and, say, look, symmetry demands. And the problem arises from the difference between having an action of the Lorentz group on the Hilbert space, which is all we usually take to be required of having a Lorentz invariant theory. But if the wave function of the universe is the law itself should be Lorentz invariant. So that means not just having an action on the Hilbert space of the Lorentz group, or whatever symmetry group we have in mind, but that wave function itself, the wave function of the universe, be invariant itself. The symmetry act trivially on that wave function. Well, it's not hard to see that that's incompatible with the covariance of the foliation map. If an invariant wave function is not going to be associated, you cannot define a foliation for an invariant wave function, because foliations can't be invariant. There's always going to be some Lorentz transformation which will tilt some surface in the foliation to get something not in the foliation. So if you think about that, it's clear that whereas for most wave functions, for a generic wave function, you could have a well-defined foliation map. You can't have it for the very kinds of very kinds of wave functions you want if the wave function is nomological as well. Variant wave functions. So you have a certain tension here. If you could have a Lorentz invariant Bohmian kind of theory involving a foliation in the manner I described, but if you do that, then psi itself cannot be Lorentz invariant. That given wave function can't be fixed under the Lorentz group. On the other hand, if psi is nomological, it should be Lorentz invariant. So you have an apparent conflict between having a Bohmian quantum theory, that psi being law-like, psi being nomological, and fundamental Lorentz invariance. And from a Bohmian point of view, something has to give. And from a Bohmian point of view, the thing to give wouldn't be the Bohmian part. Here are some possible resolutions. You could abandon, as many people suggest one should do, abandon fundamental Lorentz invariance. Another possibility would be that have a Lorentz invariant foliation, but not one which is determined by the wave function, but it's additional structure given by, say some additional field in the theory, not something definable in terms of the wave function, corresponding, for example, to something like a time function in general relativity, defined in terms of the stuff in space, not in terms of the wave function. Or the most likely possibility is something nobody thought of yet. Who knows? This is for Travis. You might think that if at the end of the day things work out in such a way that you can't maintain the idea that the wave function is nomological, then you better get rid of it and try to replace it by Attell, the theory by Attell, theory involving exclusively local viables. That's not how I feel. If it were to turn out that the wave function cannot be regarded as nomological, too complicated or whatever, wave function of the universe, I guess my reaction would be, okay, so that's just the way it is. It's not nomological, something different. That would probably be my, in fact, I think that if I had, somebody had given me a theory, Bohmian kind of theory involving exclusively local viables, a complicated collection of exclusively local viables, and then somebody else pointed out to me, aha, look, this complicated collection of exclusively local viables, the local viables can be repackaged into a non-local object of a simple mathematical character, like a wave function on configuration space. My reaction would be in that case, aha, then I prefer to think of it as that in that unusual way because of its mathematical simplicity. I realize that a lot of, there'd be probably wide disagreement about how people would react, very subjective. But that's how I would react. Yeah. This transparency is simply to indicate a certain terminological uses. Quasi-nomological. Well, I've argued that on the universal level, a property of the universe, something that somehow governs how the universe behaves, it could be thought of as a law for that universe. Not quite so easy to do that for a subsystem. So, but it's sort of natural, at least one can at least think for a subsystem that a property of the subsystem is sort of quasi-nomological, something that governs how the subsystem behaves. Let me go back to the possibilities for psi. One possibility is it's nothing. It could be subjective, representing information, epistemic. Or it could be objective. If it's objective, it could be material, or at least, or if it's not material, nomological or quasi-nomological. Here are some examples of possibilities in various kinds of physical theories. In orthodox quantum theory, the wave function is indeed quasi-nomological. It governs how wave functions behave. In Everett, it's quasi-material. It's all there is, after all. There's only the wave function. In Bohmian mechanics, consistent histories, decoherent histories, I think in causal set theory, it's quasi-nomological or nomological. In Bohm, according to Albert, where you have a fundamental, very high-dimensional configuration space and the wave function is just some field on this huge physical space, the wave function is quasi-material. In GRW CSL, the wave function is quasi-material. In quantum information, I guess it's quasi-subjective. Quasi because I guess people have different attitudes about how subjective it is. And I think I'll stop there and thank you for your attention.
More questions?
Shelley, I was wondering if you had even a toy model of the idea of a capital psi just depending upon variables, and then you follow your prescription, and you get the Schrodinger equation for the subsystem. It sounds like it doesn't need to satisfy any particular equation, the psi, just pick it. It sounds like something that could be done.
Right. I think I have several toy models. I think Hans has some models. It's something that's good to do. You probably have models. I can tell you where to find those models.
Thanks. So, Chris Timpson. In the argument coming from the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, I was wondering which of two things might be more important in your thinking on what you want to get from that argument. So is it the, as it were, the lack of time evolution that's crucial for your argument that psi is to be nomological? Or is it the idea that there's a uniquely specified universal wave functions, so there's no contingency in the initial conditions that one might think needs to be filled in by specifying a material thing?
I don't really know which is more important. They're both important to me. Of course, I guess the Wheeler-DeWitt equation does not have a unique solution. So, but at least it does pin things down a bit. They're both important.
Hi. So the big question we started with is what's the status of the wave function, and there are all these options, ontic or epistemic or gnomic and probably many more. Yeah. And you talked about the view that the big universal wave function in Bohmian mechanics should maybe be thought of as nomological. But can you say something about what you think the status is for the subsystem wave functions that you also talked about and which seem to be important in Bohmian mechanics and which, in some sense, are the wave functions that normal physicists are talking about whenever they're talking about wave functions.
Yeah, I was worried somebody was going to ask that question. The deal is this. This, I would say, what difference does it make? You know how it's defined. You know what the fundamental stuff is. Your attitude toward that is probably going to be determined by your various philosophical prejudices of one form or another. It doesn't really matter what you come in. I imagine different people will come up with different things, but it doesn't really make much difference, because what you really have to understand is the wave function of the universe. And then the things that are defined in terms of it are justly defined in terms of it. I mean, you don't have the same problem anymore. If you say, well, what, you know, what kind of weird thing is that? But once you've defined that weird thing, the wave function of a subsystem, in terms of stuff that you thoroughly understand, the problems, whatever problem you had, is just sort of evaporate. If you understand everything involved in the definition, you decide what the meaning of the thing you defined is.
Oh, I'm afraid I was not very clear yesterday on my seminar, because yesterday I showed how we can obtain these things that you talked about. I showed that I had a model for the wave function of the universe, which is very realistic, which have a background, homogeneous background, and perturbations. So the total wave functions, there is no sense of probability, nothing else, it's not evolving in time. And then what I show is that for the subsystem of perturbations, we then obtain a Schrödinger equation. And the Schrödinger equation then is ordinary Schrödinger equation, and all the things that, and these perturbations in the end give rise to everything, to galaxies, stars, ourselves,
perfect,
and all these things. So it's a realization of these
perfect,
ideas
perfect
that you presented.
You know, I wish I probably should have spoken before you, because that would have been a logical order. I wish I could have been here for the whole conference. I can only speak now. I think one of the first to do something, I don't know if it's exactly like what you did, but something in a very similar spirit was Tom Banks, who, however, didn't do things from a Bohmian point of view. He's no Bohmian, but so he had to introduce some sort of quasi-classical reasoning to put in the Bohmian stuff by hand. You know, what physicists do is put the Bohmian stuff in by hand. When they say quasi-classical, then they put in, they say, stuff can be real, we'll put it in now. But in Bohmian mechanics, it's there all along.
Hi, Mike Tyler. When you were talking about the guidance equation at the start, you were talking about the Bohmian particles having spin.
Yeah.
I thought the main implication of Bohm theory was that if you believe the wave function represents something which objectively exists, then the spin has to be a property of the wave field. Because, I mean, Schrödinger theory is for spinless particles. If you actually put in spin explicitly with spinor wave functions and the Pauli equation and so on, then the unique Bohmian guidance equation that you get is, as usual, plus a spin-dependent term. And because the quantum potential represents a portion of the wave field's energy, that implies spin has to be a property of the wave. So the explanation of spin will be something like the polarization-dependent part of the wave field's angular momentum.
Well, in Bohmian mechanics, I guess I would have no trouble with that language. I mean, the emphasis might be a little bit different. Look, the natural tendency is to, first of all, there's a wrong lesson that a lot of Bohmians seem to have drawn. Namely that what we should do in Bohmian mechanics is take all the quantum observables that we talk about and make them all real. So for every operator, we better be sure that corresponds to something real. That seems to me like an utterly pointless exercise. No reason to make everything real. There's got to be enough stuff which is taken seriously in your theory for the theory to make contact with what we see in the lab. There's no reason to introduce stuff into a theory just because our language, we talk about stuff, we talk about all these observables, so we better have stuff corresponding to those observables. That's not true in quantum information, it's not true in Bohm, it's bad. That's not the lesson, that you reify everything. Now, but because the first thought that occurs to you is you should reify spin. You should make, there should be an extra discrete variable, just like there's a continuous variable for the positions of stuff, there should be a discrete variable for the spin of stuff. If you do that, you make a real mess. If you don't worry about that, which you shouldn't do because there's no reason whatsoever to worry about that, just take the kind of wave function in quantum mechanics that describes spin, spinner-valued wave function, then you don't have to do anything else. Everything is hunky-dory. That's saying spin is in the wave function, like you said.
Monalita Arakshani. So it is entirely possible that the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is the wrong way to do quantum gravity, and that really what we should be doing is writing down a pilot wave version of the string theory version of Schrodinger's equation, in which case there would be a time-dependent wave function solution to that equation, and then one could not derive time-dependent Schrodinger equations from as subsystems, you know, of the universe. If that turns out to be the right way to do quantum gravity.
I'm not following what you asked, though. You said if you have a time-dependent wave function of the universe, you cannot derive a time-dependent wave Schrodinger.
No. If the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is the wrong way to do quantum gravity, then we cannot use this argument to say that there is some time-independent wave function of the universe, right?
Right. You wouldn't be able to use that argument involving the Wheeler-DeWitt equation if that weren't the relevant equation.
Right. So if that turns out to be the case, then can you talk about what you think is the most congenial interpretation, physical interpretation of the wave function in the pilot?
That's too vague. If it happens that the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is not the right equation, what do I think is the most likely possibility? I don't know. I mean, I would still say the most likely possibility is that the wave function. For me, probably the most likely possibility, honestly, is that quantum mechanics is not to be taken that seriously. In 100 years, our physical theory will be entirely different. But physicists, and I don't like to think that way. I like to take my physics really seriously, far seriously than I can reasonably be justified. So now doing that, I would say, okay, if I have to take quantum mechanics seriously, then the way to think about the wave function is nomological. So I would hope that other developments, even if it doesn't correspond to the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, are consistent with that.
Richard Healy, you say you want the wave function to be thought of as nomological. And one reason for saying that is because it enters into the fundamental dynamical law of Bohmian mechanics.
Because what?
Enters into the formulation of the fundamental dynamical law of Bohmian mechanics. It also enters into a statement of the quantum equilibrium condition. Does that make it more nomological, or is that irrelevant because your concept of nomological is a law of time development?
And I have a feeling it's pretty much irrelevant. I mean, suppose it were material. The analysis of equilibrium would, I guess, be pretty much the same. The only difference could be some sort of subtle difference, because in terms of the mathematics, it would be the same. Configurations going to equilibrium or being in the same kind of arguments which have been given, which are mathematical arguments, wouldn't depend on this philosophical distinction, nomological or not nomological. That, as I said, has implications in terms of simplicity, but that has nothing to do with that. No. So the equilibrium, the statistical behavior is simply is something you arrive at by a sort of standard statistical mechanical kind of analysis of that dynamical system. So it doesn't really make much difference how you regard psi with that.
So there was something I didn't quite understand. And a question in there. You said the evolution of the subsystem wave function could conceivably be understood in terms of a time-independent universal wave function. But because of the time dependence of the Bohmian configurations of the environment, I could get a time dependence for the subsystem wave function. My question is, given that in the standard Bohmian picture, there's an underdetermination in the nature of the dynamics, I can change the guidance equation. For example, Samuel Collin talked yesterday about curl terms. So there's many ways in which you can change the guidance equation. You can introduce stochasticity. And typically, the wisdom is that doesn't change the operational predictions. But it would change the evolution of the subsystem wave function if the Bohmian configuration of the environment were changing differently. And so it seems to me that there could only be one of those choices which would lead to a subsystem wave function evolving according to the Schrodinger equation. Is that right?
I doubt that that's true, by the way. I think probably most Some of those choices may not, but I think more than one, that would be very nice if it were true. That it would be very nice if it were true that the demand that wave functions of subsystems in the right situation, in the usual situations, do evolve according to Schrodinger, that picked out uniquely Bohm. I doubt that it does. But there's a paper on that by Rimini and a collaborator, unfortunately I can't remember his name, about compoundation invariance, which is very much in that spirit about whether or not, to what extent the Bohm equations are special with regard to behaviors of subsystems or forming bigger systems from smaller systems and things like that.
So it is possible then that all of these dynamics nonetheless lead to the same dynamics for the subsystem wave function.
Many of them. I doubt it would be true for all, because you can make up all kinds, some kind of crazy dynamics. Now, the ones which were mentioned yesterday, I'm not sure. It could well be the case that for all of those that we talked about, the same story would go. Wouldn't be surprised at all.
Thanks.
Howard Wiseman. Just further to Rob's question, I think maybe it needs further clarification. Correct me, I mean, I'll make a statement and you tell me if you agree or not. I would have thought that in the situation where all observers would agree what the wave function of the subsystem was, in other words, in which there's classical information out there which would enable all observers to agree what state to ascribe to the subsystem, then the evolution of that wave function for the subsystem would not depend on which particular, you know, Bohmian velocity was chosen for the environment.
That's the sort of thing that drives my statement in the direction of robustness. But I suspect that you can make up some really idiotic Bohmian. Let's not call it Bohmian anymore. I mean, I don't know what Bohmian means anymore. I mean, is it the specific equations that are used, or should it be understood broadly? I usually like to think of it kind of broadly, as you are now. You make up something really horrible, and it's probably not going to be true. So that might be a good reason for this. And maybe you might wonder, okay, so maybe such a theory, despite all the claims to the contrary, that namely such a theory, because it's still compatible with psi-squared probabilities, that it has to be empirically equivalent to orthodox quantum theory and to Bohmian mechanics. So maybe there's some subtleties there as well. You would think that if you don't have Schrodinger's equation for subsystems, there's some sense in which you're not going to have equivalence. So one needs to look more carefully at actually exactly what the right statement of even of equivalence is if we, in situations like this. I think this needs to be looked at more carefully.
I just would like to make a comment about this validity equation problem that he mentioned. Yes, of course, the validity equation might not be the right way to quantize gravity. But there are very general arguments, for instance, Julian Barber spelled these arguments, that claims that at the most fundamental level, quantum gravity is timeless. Time should be something that should be an emergent concept also. So in this way, from these general arguments, I think your postulation that psi should be nomological is quite adequate.
You know, from Barber's point of view, though, I mean, he means really super timeless. It's not timeless like you have with four-dimensional space-time. There's just a single three-dimensional reality for Barber. Wave function's law is not going to cut it for Barber, that's for sure. Because there's nothing to be evolving. There really isn't any other variable. There's just a bunch of three-dimensional snapshots.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker again. It's time for coffee.